Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Dr. Jim Moore is a professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. He earned his doctorate in political science at Northwestern University in 1995 and has been one of the most quoted political analysts in Oregon in the 21st century. I'm excited to welcome Professor Jim Moore to the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome, Jim.
It's good to be with you.
So let's start with a simple question. I recently received my ballot in the mail. Have you voted yet?
I certainly have. I always try to be the person who gets it in the first day. So when it comes, I just fill everything in and turn it right back around and get it off into the mail.
Well, you're setting an example for all of us. So what's top of mind for you in this election at the local, state, and national levels?
Certainly. So there's a variety of interesting measures going on across the state. But what I'm really looking for kind of at the local level is who people's representatives are in Salem. Salem is going to be where so much is going to be happening in 2025. So who's going to be actually sitting there? Remember, we've got a number of Republican senators who can't run again. So who are their replacements going to be? We know that four out of the five are going to be Republicans, but what are they going to come into Salem looking to do? How do they want to accomplish it? That kind of thing is what I'm really looking at.
Okay. When you say they aren't able to run again, can you expound on that a little bit?
Sure. So Oregon has a law that says if you miss in the legislature more than 10 unexcused absences, you are barred from running again for your office. And so because of the walkouts that the Republicans were using as a tactic, there were a number of Oregon senators who met that threshold and were banned from running again. About half of them decided they weren't going to run again anyway, but the other half were basically forced out. And so I'm looking at kind of who the new faces are, how do they view what should happen in Salem, how do they think they should work in the legislature in Salem.
Are there any particular measures that are top of mind for you?
You know, Oregon's kind of got sleepy measures this year. I'm interested in all of them, but you know, none of them are really grabbing attention. People may remember, you know, in the 1990s, we were leading the pack with big things on property taxes, gay rights, you know, all sorts of things like that, assisted suicide, you know, those kinds of things. But we're not doing that right now. So I'm very interested in basically, does Oregon decide that it's going to be able to impeach its executive officers, joining most of the rest of the country in doing that? I think that voters will vote for that. I don't think there will be any problem with that. Also interested, there's the measure that the legislature referred out to the people, basically saying, do you want ranked choice voting for some of these statewide offices and federal offices? And so I'll be interested to see what people have to say on that. It's a little different flavor up here in the Portland area where I am, because the city of Portland is going with two forms of ranked choice voting for its city offices. So it's confusing and delightful up here. I'll just be interested in what the rest of the state has to say on that. So those are two of them. But once again, none of them are stars. We're not finding national media saying, ooh, what does Oregon have on the ballot in this election year?
Now, speaking of national media, what are your thoughts about how the media have framed the presidential election?
Fascinating. This election, like the 2020 election, was always going to be a referendum on Donald Trump. Remember, Joe Biden became the nominee in 2020 because he was considered the most electable. Who was he? Yeah, that was kind of secondary. It was mainly who's most electable against Trump. Here we are in 2024, and that same dynamic is out there to a large extent. And the media have taken that, and it's not clear to me sometimes how they're covering it. Donald Trump, you know, is Donald Trump, and people support him strongly. We still have some phenomenal percentage. It's like about 75 or 80% of Republicans strongly support Donald Trump. And so when he does things that, if you're not one of his supporters, seem bizarre, that doesn't really matter. It doesn't shake the faith of the people who are really supporting him. And the media have a hard time covering that. So we have an interesting dynamic going on. Kamala Harris is getting critiqued for not being precise enough when she's talking about policy issues, whereas Donald Trump is never precise about anything, and he gets a pass on that kind of thing. But that's just Donald Trump being Donald Trump. I'm not sure if the media coverage was different, it would change how people feel about either candidate, especially as we get this close to the election. But it's just a fascinating thing to watch. People are more solidified in who they are going to support in this election than they have been really going back about 45 years.
Well, it seems in my recollection of how media have covered the presidential election, this presidential election and previous ones, the last couple ones, is that the more they expose who Donald Trump is, his past, his problems, his scandals, his pathology, there's an assumption that that exposure is going to somehow have an influence on the electorate, when there seems to be a realization that Donald Trump is a reflection of a majority of the dominant culture. Is it not?
I think that he's not only a reflection, I think he's a symbol of the dominant culture. But it's also, you know, what does Donald Trump really stand for? And for the people who support Donald Trump, and especially support him strongly, they are frustrated with government. They're frustrated at all levels. I would bet that if we were to look at Eastern Oregon, the counties that voted to join Idaho, I bet if we were to look at them, we'd see a one-to-one matching up of the people who voted to join Idaho with people who support Donald Trump. So they're frustrated at all levels. And Donald Trump, with all the things about him, Donald Trump is a change agent. What does that change to? It's not clear at all, but it's definitely a change from the way things are right now. And I think in that, he's a phenomenally successful candidate. Is he successful enough to win the presidency? We'll find out next week. But it's a strong message. And this is a message, this goes back to Ronald Reagan saying, you know, the scariest words in the English language are, "Hello, I'm from the government, I'm here to help." So this has been something that's been building for a long, long, long time. It is settled in the Republican Party, but it's a long-standing issue with Americans and how they feel their lives are being run or not run from far away from Washington, D.C. in this case.
Well, it's very interesting because I still recall Donald Trump saying he believes he could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose a single vote. I think he was wrong on that. I think he'd actually gain some votes.
That's very, very easily could be the case.
My guest is Dr. Jim Moore. He is a professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. He is also the most quoted political analyst in Oregon over the past 30 years. Okay, so let's take a step back in your personal history, Jim. Civic engagement is a responsibility that many parents try to instill in our children as a responsibility of being a citizen, but it doesn't always work. So how did you first develop an interest in politics?
It was just a part of the air that I breathed. My grandfather was in Brookings and was on the school board. My dad was the anchor at KOBI television in Medford, Oregon. And then he ran for and won a seat on the county commission in Jackson County. So it was just around. The members of my church, one of the members of my church was John Dellenbach, who was our member of Congress. So it was just all around. It was part of seeing that you needed to be engaged and you needed to be paying attention to what was happening in the political community and the larger community.
Was your family involved in politics at all?
Well, my dad was a county commissioner. He served one term. He did not make it through the Republican primary for a second term. But it was something that was not necessarily within my family. There were little bits of it there, but also just seeing how important it was. I was always the kid growing up, and then when I went away to college, I was the one who was reading tons of newspapers and paying attention to all sorts of news. And people would ask me, so how do we understand what's going on? And so I was the one who was kind of helping them understand what was going on. So that was just a constant for me almost from sixth or seventh grade on.
You know, it's a very interesting point because a lot of people do depend upon their social networks, their families, their friends, to help them understand the political landscape. How would you characterize the political parties and what they represent in general?
Well, it's fascinating. I've got a class that I'm teaching right now. I've been teaching it since 1992. Every student in it has to go out and volunteer in a campaign. It's really wonderful. And what my students are seeing is they're out knocking on doors. I have a number of them who are doing city council races, so they're nonpartisan. They knock on the door and they say, hi, here's my candidate. If the person wants to talk, they talk. Here's the stance on issues, blah, 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 blah. But at some point, the person whose door they've knocked on says, what party are they? And if the student says Republican, then a certain number of people are just going to close the door saying, oh, I never vote for Republicans, even though I like this person's stance on issues. And the same thing if the student says Democrat. People will just shut down. Fascinating, looking at the United States in about the past 10 to 15 years it's been building. Political party identity is a bigger divider than race. So remember the movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that kind of thing?
Yes, Sidney Poitier.
Yeah, exactly. And that was all about race. Now it's about political party. Oh, my gosh, you're bringing the Democrat home. Ah, what are we going to do? And so the parties have become places where we put our identities and we use them basically as a code for how we feel about the world. When you push very hard, when you get into issues, it's a much grayer set of issues. But when we talk about political parties, they're teams. And the teams right now, I think, are in the way of governing rather than helping to govern.
So that's very interesting. So we have come to identify ourselves as political opponents, if you will.
Yeah. And then think about Oregon. The biggest single group we have is unaffiliated. I don't want to be a part of either team. When we look at how the unaffiliated vote, it turns out they do vote with one team or the other, but they adamantly don't want to be considered part of either side in terms of their own public identity. And so it's just fascinating to watch how that plays out. Here's an interesting thing about the unaffiliated in Oregon. We're looking at the voter turnout right now as we watch the ballots come in. Right now, if you're registered as a Democrat or Republican, the voting rate is three times higher than it is if you're an unaffiliated voter. So unaffiliated voters are less likely to engage because they're not part of the team. They don't want to have that motivation. They don't want to have that badge. And I just find it just fascinating to watch all this play out.
Well, it's quite interesting because we also identify as gender or along a spectrum of gender. We also identify by religion, by faith. And so the most polarizing area seems to be when we identify along political lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And both political parties have done it in the past, but the Republicans are doing it right now. They're trying to blend some of that in there. So especially in these last 3 weeks of the presidential campaign, and then I'm seeing it, the Portland area has got three amazingly competitive congressional races going on. So we're seeing it in those congressional races. The Republicans are beginning to run ads that say, watch out, Democrats will allow biological men to go into your daughter's locker room. So they're focusing on trans rights and say, no, there's just two genders. So they're trying to blend that political identity together with the sexual spectrum. Fascinating to watch that play out as well. It's backfiring in some parts of the country. In some parts of the country, it's working really well.
Well, that's certainly true. And, of course, I've heard Marjorie Taylor Greene, raise the roof about her white Christian nationalism and how proud she is as a white Christian nationalist. So now we have the faith that's involved in that identity as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been a long time. I mean, Southern Oregon, Medford used to be the home of the moral majority in Oregon. It was the headquarters. So we've been seeing this for quite some time in politics. But if you go back in Oregon in the 1960s and into the 1950s, you get the Democrats were playing the race card all the time. The Republicans were the ones who were saying, no, there should be civil rights. And so the parties dip into this when they feel it's to their advantage, when it begins to build the coalition that lasts from election to election.
That's a great segue. We have to take a short break. We'll be back with Dr. Jim Moore, the professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. And he's also the most quoted political analyst in Oregon over the past 30 years. I can't wait to come right back with Dr. Jim Moore. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Jim Moore. He is a professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. He's also the most quoted political analyst in Oregon over the past 30 years. Now, Jim, just before the break, we were getting into a little bit of history. So give me a minute. I want to set up this next question by establishing some historical context for this current political atmosphere that's blanketing our nation. All right, so back in 1860, the Republican Party was the home of a radical youth movement known as the Wide Awakes, and they were young people with a huge support for Abraham Lincoln. And after his assassination in 1865, just weeks after signing into law the Freedmen's Bureau, it was the white radicals in Congress who centered and prioritize the political and economic empowerment of black people for the very first time in American history. These white radicals were radical Republicans. Today, the Republican Party has declared war on wokeism and DEI, which the Freedmen's Bureau represented, and the GOP today is the home of white supremacists, white Christian nationalists, and a candidate who has declared his intention to become a fascist dictator on day one if elected. And finally, in this last election in 2020, 92% of black voters supported the Democratic Party, according to the latest Pew Research data. So how did the Republican Party transition from centering and prioritizing the political and economic empowerment of black people seven generations ago to being the party that black people overwhelmingly reject today?
Well, remember, Abraham Lincoln became president. The Republicans had been around just for 6 years at that point. They are the most successful third party ever in American politics. They came into being, and the Whigs simply went out of business. And so as the Republican Party was figuring out what it was simultaneously the party of what we would now call civil rights, but it was also the party of business. And that duality kind of clashed within the party, but it worked out. The Republican Party dominated the presidencies of the 19th century. And it's not really until you get to Woodrow Wilson in 1912 that you have the Democrats begin to break through in a meaningful way and come in and win national elections. What happened along the way is that we got to the 1930s, and that Republican coalition of civil rights black voters was pretty ragged at that point, partly because of the Great Depression. The economics was really, really tough, partly because we were beginning to see that blacks were leaving the South. They were going in the Great Migration. They were heading up to the industrial areas. They've been doing that, going to Chicago and Detroit and places like that. But it was ragged. And so FDR, in the election of 1932, put together a new coalition. And that new coalition basically got the black voters to come over to the Democratic Party. And then FDR had to balance black voters in the Democratic Party with the avowedly Jim Crow white Democrats who were in power in the South. And so that set up a tension on the Democratic side around race. And then that began to shift, especially in the 1950s and really in the 1960s. Richard Nixon made it a hallmark to basically convert Democrats who were in the Jim Crow South, convert them to Republicans. And he was very successful. By the time we get to the mid-70s, that conversion is complete. And when you look through the South right now, very rare to find a Democrat who holds a congressional seat or a gubernatorial seat or anything like that. It happens, but it's extremely rare. So it's the shifting coalitions. And the ping pong ball and all that is black voters.
It's interesting.
There's a big question. Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting that you mentioned Nixon, because in 1960, Nixon barely lost to JFK by 1% because of black voters, but he still got about 32% of the black vote. By the time you get to 1968 and you're past the 64 Civil Rights Act, you're past the 65 Voting Rights Act, you're past the assassination of Dr. King in 68 and Senator Kennedy in 68 as well. Now Nixon gets elected, but black voters are something like less than 15% in favor of Nixon, and then it just plummets from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you're watching it take place right at that crucial point. And it's fascinating to watch. You know, once again, here in Oregon, in the 1950s and into the 1960s, the Republicans were the Civil Rights Party. This is the party of Mark Hatfield, the party of Tom McCall. Then that began to shift nationally, and it began to shift here in Oregon as well. And so by the time you get to the 1980s, that flip has happened, and we see black voters here in Oregon basically saying, you know, even at the state level, I'm going with the Democrats no matter what. So it's a change that happens, you know, here, and it happens across the country. But it's relatively quick, and it's really amazing how big the shift has been.
Is it because black voters view a vision of America that is diverse, inclusive, and has equitable access to the American dream of prosperity for everyone, and that dream they don't see the Republican Party representing?
It very easily could be. It could also be that black voters looked out there and said, we're getting nothing from Republican policies, so let's go get Democratic policies. And the things that you mentioned from the 1960s, Democratic Congresses passed those. They were signed into law by Democratic presidents. And so they said, great, we're seeing now fraying of that African-American black coalition again, because people are saying, so what have you done for me, Democratic Party? Not much. You know, it seems to be you're assuming that we're going to support you. We need to see actual change happen, especially after Black Lives Matter in the last several years. Has there been meaningful change at the federal level? You know, that's not even an open question. I don't think there has been. And so the black coalition, I think, is beginning to fray at the edges, but Trump may be a step too far to go vote for Trump at this point.
My guest is Dr. Jim Moore. He's a professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. He is also the most quoted political analyst in Oregon over the past 30 years, and I'm beginning to see why. Jim, given the demographic shifts occurring in our population that we're talking about and the shifts that have already occurred in K-12, if you could wave a magic wand and create the conditions for our nation in the near future, tell me about the America that you envision in 2030.
So an America that I envision in 2030 would be an outward-looking America. We've always been a country of immigrants, whether you're forced because of slavery or whether you choose to leave because you were poor or whatever. And so we need to be looking outward. We're a part of the world. So what I would like to see is people saying, hey, maybe I should learn a foreign language because, you know, I need to talk to people in China, not just be afraid of people in China. I would like to see a United States that says, let's go work out in the world, but we have to do it fairly. We have a really long history in this country, in modern terms, dating back 100 years, of saying, hey, we'll come help you as long as you do it totally on our terms and we make a huge profit. So let's change that and actually give the help that is needed in areas around the world. That's what I'd like to see. I don't think we're heading there. It's partly because of Donald Trump, but the Democrats have also, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, have adopted. We need to keep tariffs on and kind of keep the world out right now. That may be where the American public is going, but I would really love to see it shift. We are a better country when we're an active part of the world and working with other parts of the world, not at other parts of the world.
Well, I've heard the saying many times that all politics is local. So let's dive into the local issues. What challenges do you see for voters in your region and around the state?
I think the big challenge, let's just look at the election itself right now and just the mechanics of it. Everybody knows what's going on with the presidential election. My big fear is they're going to do what people do in that situation, and they are not going to vote for issues down the ballot. So that's an issue that is a voter education issue, but it's hard for them to get education when the media coverage is basically all about the presidential election. Big issues. You know, we talk about things like homelessness. We talk about things like the economy. We talk about things like drugs. You know, those are certainly important issues, but those are issues that are very difficult to solve, and I'm not sure the political will is there. The other big thing out there is clearly climate change. Fascinating to watch that over the years that I've been doing this. Republicans have basically said, oh, climate change may be a hoax. Oh, it's not as bad as you think. I give talks all over the place. And beginning about 30 years ago, when I would talk to agricultural groups, they were saying, hey, the climate's changing. My cherries are not blooming at the right time. I'm not getting the crop that I need. I have to shift what I'm doing. So it's fascinating that the Republicans out in the agricultural world are seeing climate change and have been seeing it for decades, even though it's still a fight within the Republican Party to acknowledge it. So I'd like to see those kinds of things begin to be dealt with. But it requires not just good politicians. It requires voters who do the research, who care and push for solutions. Not just weighing in every 2 or 4 years when there's a big election, but paying attention in between and saying, oh, I need to help guide this, need to join an organization to guide it, maybe need to testify about it or do the research or something like that. It requires a really engaged electorate as well as the politicians.
Well, we're getting close on time, but I need to know, what's the next big thing for you? A book project, research, travel, leisurely retirement? What?
I am retiring. This is my last election, my 9th presidential election. And when you look at special elections and things like that in Oregon, I'm up to about 25 elections. So this is my very last one. I am going to be traveling a lot more. I'm going to be reading books. I have written a book, a biography of Oregon's last Republican governor, Vic Atiyah. It's with a publisher right now, so I hope that comes out very shortly. And I'm looking forward to kind of switching gears and kind of getting out of the politics game and doing something else.
Are you sure you won't run for office yourself?
Absolutely. I watched my father do it. I've watched a lot of other people do it. I've consulted with politicians. It was very clear to me even before I got into this, I would love to be appointed to be the U.S. Secretary of State, but running for president, you got to be nuts to do that. So I think I'm not going to be running for anything in terms of politics.
What about media?
I think the media is done with this kind of stuff. You know, if I develop something else, I certainly have a lot of reporters' numbers in my collection. But this kind of stuff is done. My television station up here and my radio station are kind of sad about that. But I've been doing it for 33 years, and it's time for somebody else to step in.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thank you, Jim, for joining me on The Exchange and sharing your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
My guest was Dr. Jim Moore. He is a professor at Pacific University and director of political outreach at the Tom McCall Center for Civic Engagement. He is also the most quoted political analyst in Oregon in the 21st century, and now you know why. I'm Mike Green.